Second argument of the morning is in Appeal Number 24-1576, the United States v. Clarence Bonds. Just hold on one second, Mr. Patton.
Sure.
Okay, Mr. Patton, good morning, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. For 60 years, courts at every level of the federal judiciary, Congress, and the administrative office of the courts have correctly interpreted the Criminal Justice Act to allow judges to appoint counsel as needed in criminal cases, including appointing a lawyer to help a poor person litigate their motion for a reduction in their sentence. That 60 years of history belies the government's argument that the plain language of the statute forbids such appointments. The government's reading of the statute creates a circuit split, renders huge swaths of the statute meaningless, and creates the very problem that the act was designed to fix. Any one of those issues would be enough to reject the government's argument. And in combination, they show just how radical the government's argument is. The past 60 years have not been a mistake. The CJA allows a district court to appoint lawyers to help poor defendants litigate Section 3582C cases. And that's why year after year, the judiciary has submitted budgets to Congress, telling Congress that we need money to pay lawyers to litigate these motions, and Congress then appropriates the money. Your Honors, this court decided this issue long before Foster in Tidwell in 1999. This court itself appointed counsel under the CJA Act to represent a defendant in a 3582C case. And that defendant had been represented in the district court under the CJA by the Federal Defender's Office in Rockford. And the very issue, one of the very issues in Tidwell was the appointment of counsel in 3582C cases. And this court specifically held the judge can appoint counsel for a movant, but need not do so. In Johnson in 2009, again, a case where out of Rockford, where the district court appointed the Federal Public Defender's Office, then under the CJA, there was an appeal. They argued that the appointment should have been mandatory and it should have been earlier in the process. And this court addressed that specific issue and said that there is no right to counsel in a Section 3582C2 proceeding, and the decision whether to appoint counsel is left to the district court's discretion.
And Mr. Patton, where in the statute do you find that discretion?
Your Honor, the discretion comes when the statute provides coverage for a defendant or a person, an eligible person in the language of the statute, who is charged with a felony. These are all felony offenses. Now, I think, you know, the question comes, even under our reading, the shall becomes a may, right? And that's the issue, right? And the government's response is, well, it shall, and by the way, we're perfectly happy if you say the shall goes through the entire criminal case. Some of my colleagues might, you know, regret that when we get all the cases. But the government's response is, well, no, subsection C puts a hard end to a district court's authority to appoint counsel under the act after direct appeal. But the problem with that is that if you try and read C that way, it renders virtually all of the coverage in subsection A, both A1 and A2, meaningless.
Yeah, so I think you make some points that, look, it's hard to square all this. I think those are fair points. What if you go back to the question that you have your finger on, right, when you locate the discretion in A1A, mm-hmm. You with me on that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, when you locate it there, the challenge is, what do you make of A2 then? Because by the structure of it, there's this discretionary provision,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, and I think your caveat to the question ultimately provides the answer, correct? And that is that you can't square all of the provisions of the Act. You can't read it as a functioning whole, mm-hmm. by the plain language, which means there's ambiguity, which means then this court has to look at other clues to try and figure out what is the best reading of the statute, trying to find out what Congress meant this statute, this language to mean. And all of those clues, we have remarkably strong clues on that because we saw how Congress has actually amended the statute, and we know that those amendments were made in response to the Oaks Report.
Okay. Okay. This is good. Help me out then on it. Your point about ambiguity is well taken when you look at the statutory scheme as a whole and you kind of brainstorm about what about this and what, mm-hmm. about that. When you narrow it down, Mr. Patton, to the exact question before us, the appointment of counsel in a case like this, mm-hmm. an 821 or whatever the circumstance may be, what's your best articulation of ambiguity on that precise question?
Your Honor, ambiguity means looking at the statute as a whole, right? Because ambiguity is just not, I can read these five words in this subsection to mean something. And so there's no ambiguity, except when you then try and transfer, use that reading of those words to try and make the statute coherent as a whole.
Let me ask it a different way. Let me ask it a different way. So I could see the best argument I think you have is frankly, it's the one you're pressing under A1 capital A, right? That you need to really need to interpret charged with a felony to include the entirety of the proceeding, including something, you know, really post-judgment like that kind of motion. But then you'd say that appointment is occurring on a discretionary basis, right?
Sure.
It's occurring on a discretionary basis within a subsection of the statute that is unambiguous on it being mandatory.
In other words, I thought what
you might say is it's frankly mandatory.
We're fine with that. Look, Judge,
you'd have a staffing problem. I get that.
Those budget requests will change.
But that's the ambiguity.
In all honest,
yeah, go
Judge
ahead.
Cutter, I don't think in good faith I could make that argument because I don't think that's what, I mean, I've read the Oaks Report. I've seen how Congress reacted to the Oaks Report, right? And if you go back to the 1970 amendments and Congress is trying to figure out, you know, how this new statute that's really a major undertaking in creating a new structure for appointing counsel to poor people, right? And so Congress knew they were going to have to amend it and update it. And so they ask the Department of Justice and the judiciary, study this, come back, help us write this statute in a way that achieves its goal of making sure poor people get adequate representation. And one of the issues they address is this very issue. And said the proper way to address it is to understand that the language that authorizes appointments in felony cases covers the entire criminal case. Because remember, the Act wasn't purporting to create a new right to counsel or expand the right to counsel. The Supreme Court had already held the Sixth Amendment required appointment of counsel from initial appearance through direct appeal, but that courts always had the discretion to appoint counsel if they felt that was necessary to help them reach the right decision on a disputed issue.
Go ahead, Judge Hamilton.
Go ahead.
But the issues raised in the Oaks Report were actually, the specific issues were addressed in the statute, right? So He talked about violation of supervised release, for example, and the seeking relief under 2241, 2254, like the hate. I mean, those in my mind were kind of the principal goal, the omissions that the Oaks report kind of focused on. And it seems to me, on with regard to the statute itself, you know, I kind of struggle with the same question that Judge Scudder struggles with, which is you have a provision, a subsection that is mandatory, you have one that is discretionary. Aren't you asking us just to create another subsection under subsection 2, that is 2C, that would require, that would give the district court discretion to appoint in these types of cases? And if so, to me, that I don't know if that's properly called ambiguity.
Well, that's not what we're asking you to do, Judge Lee. And if you back up, if you look at appendix page 25, you'll see the section of the Oaks report that is contained in the section called coverage, a specific section that deals with the motions that get filed in the district court long after judgment, long after the original trial counsel's voucher is paid. They're talking about new trial motions, then Rule 35B motions, which were motions to modify the sentence that could be filed up to 6 months after the end of the district, the direct appeal. That's what they were talking about when they said, no, the act covers those. We know they cover them because then they add this new statutory maximum payment of up to $250 for filing those types of motions. At the same time, they add the discretionary appointments for material witnesses and 2255's habeas attacks. And the reason they did it that way is because the Oaks reports said the language for appointments in felony cases covers the entire criminal case. But if it's going to be something outside the criminal case, like a collateral attack, if you want the act to cover that, you need to amend it to add that coverage. So they weren't trying to take away coverage in the criminal case by giving the judge's discretion to broaden the scope of it, right? Because if you think about it, what you're really be saying, if you interpret the act this way, the narrowest coverage in the act is for the criminal case. If you say,
Mr. Patton, could I ask you some factual questions here?
Yes, sir.
First of all, is Mr. Bond still scheduled for release on January 31st next year?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. You're on the front lines of this. Are 3582C motions going to CJA panel attorneys, or are they all being handled by federal defender operations?
It varies from district, Your Honor. For example, in our district, we do them all. Okay. There's an administrative order. We get every single one. That's the way they're mainly doing them here in Chicago. It's just there's some districts here that are arguing it.
That's all I need to know. Two more questions. One, let me just ask you to address a sentence. I'm just going to pick this out in subsection C.
Yes, sir.
It's about
in the second, the last sentence of C.
If at any stage of the proceedings, including an appeal, the U.S. magistrate judge or the court finds that the person is financially unable to pay counsel whom he had retained, it may appoint counsel as provided in subsection B, etc., as the interests of justice may dictate.
Yes. That seems to be much broader, right, than limited, a hard limit to just between initial appearance and appeal.
And the 3582C motions are filed in the original criminal docket.
Absolutely,
correct?
Correct.
Okay. Now, my next question I will address to both sides. I realize that the court asked you all this question, and I'm grateful for the outstanding advocacy on both sides in briefing this. Can you tell me why we're not being just asked in this case to provide an advisory opinion?
Well, Your Honor,
will our answer to the statutory question have any effects on Mr. Bonds or in his case?
It could, Your Honor. And look, things would have to move at lightning speed, of course, right? And with regard to the timing, it's potentially worse than an advisory opinion. I'm not conceding that the case becomes moot after January 31st, 2025, but there's
a
serious...
We can get an opinion. We can get an opinion out before then.
Right. But I don't think you can rule against us without going en banc or Rule 40E. And, you know, whether that can get done by January 20th, you all know that more than I do, but it's a concern that we have. But I take your point, Judge Hamilton, that things would have to move incredibly quickly to get a practical. And of course, even if we win, it doesn't mean Mr. Bonds automatically gets a shorter sentence. It just means it goes back to Judge Lighty and, you know, he considers it again. And, you know, he could deny it.
So, no, but maybe I'm missing something.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm missing something basic, but what if we agree with your position on the funding?
Yes, sir.
But don't see an abuse of discretion in the denial.
I apologize, Your Honor. Look, obviously, we think there was an abuse of discretion, but I get your point of, hey, if we don't think there was anything there, we just don't get to it. I get that.
Let's, regardless of what we think of the merits.
Okay.
How does our answer on the funding question have any practical effect in this case?
Well, I will tell you that we have been told by Defender Services that if you guys issue an opinion that says they can't give funding for this in the Seventh Circuit, every defender office is going to be prohibited from.
That sounds like we're being asked to substitute our views and our responsibilities under Article 3 for the role of the General Counsel of the Administrative Office and the Judicial Congress.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Okay. I agree with that.
Thank you. That, I think, is all I had. Okay.
We'll give you some rebuttal time.
All right, thank you.
Thanks,
I'm
Mr.
sorry
Brown.
I didn't pick up on that question.
Do you have any other points you want to make?
Your Honor, if you give me a couple minutes for rebuttal, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, yep, great. Mr. Holler, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Judge Hamilton, I guess I'll try to start with your questions. Mr. Bond's term with the Bureau of Prisons is scheduled to end on January 31st of 2025. He has agreed that his period of supervised release will begin with time in a halfway house where he is now, so I don't think anything practical will change, but that is the termination date.
Thank you.
Purposes of deciding the question of whether Judge Lichty abused his discretion. On the question that the court added, I guess my answer to you, Judge Hamilton, would be that certainly the court could conclude that it doesn't need to decide the question. What I would say is that the order does provisionally appoint Mr. Patton. If the court were to determine that that appointment was statutorily impermissible, it would strike me that at least on a going forward basis, as of the moment of the issuance of the judgment, essentially Mr. Patton's appointment should terminate, whereas otherwise he would remain in the case and would be free to file and bank cert petitions, etc. It strikes me that that is what, if the court were to write an opinion, that would be the live issue in the case. I think you had three questions, and I forgot what your middle one was. I apologize.
Middle question was about appointment. Mr. Patton asked that, and then there was a third question about the sentence in subsection C that's pretty broad.
Okay. I'll answer both those questions. In this circuit, my understanding is virtually all appointments are being made to the public defender, and I believe that is in part because of Foster, which some have interpreted to suggest that maybe panel attorneys can't be paid, but the public defender can. Nationally, there is a wide variety of appointments that are being made. So I do think that a decision here or any kind of decision reaffirming Foster, abrogating Foster, et cetera, could lead to certain changes. If the court does not decide this issue, it would be nice for the court, I guess, to give this has to be resolved in some fashion here, right? We briefed this issue in the Hardin case. We briefed this issue here. I think Mr. Patton and I would both like to not continue to brief the issue if the court is not going to resolve the issue. That's all I'll say.
It's our problem, not yours.
If the court does not want to resolve the issue, the court should give a clear indication that it does not want to resolve the issue and it's not going to ask us about this issue further, I guess, is what I would
say. Fair enough. Thank you.
So now to turn to the merits. Okay, so what I would say about this statute, first of all, is I agree that it is not a model of clarity. I think Mr. Patton has very helpfully included the 1964 version, the 1970 version, and the current version. So I am going to, in response first to the questions from Judge Scudder and Judge Lee, I do believe that he's not asking us to interpret an ambiguous statute. He's asking us to cross out the word, either cross out the word shall in section one and add the word may, or add the number 3582 to A2B. So I think that's what he's asking us to do. And so in response to your point, Judge Hamilton, this language has always been in the statute. It was in the statute in 1964. So it said from the very beginning, a person shall be represented at every stage of the proceedings from his initial appearance before, at the time it was the commissioner, through appeal, including ancillary matters, was added later. And then, so this is, I'm not going to have this up right, but let's see. So this is going to be on page 7 of the appendix, is going to show how it originally, C originally looked. So it's every stage of the proceedings from his initial appearance before the United States commissioner, that's what magistrates were at the time, or court through appeal. If at any time after the appointment of counsel, the court finds the defendant is financially unable to obtain counsel, he may terminate the appointment.
Financially able to obtain counsel.
Find that he is financially able, they can terminate.
Yeah.
And if at any time they find that he is financially unable, they may appoint counsel. So, I mean, I just see that as sort of like during the time frame we're talking about, which is from initial hearing through appeal, this is a toggle switch. You can, okay, now you're financially able, you don't get counsel. Now you're financially unable, you do get counsel. But I don't view this as extending that and saying now, even in outside of this time frame, right? The statute, the heading itself in 1964 says duration and substitution of appointments. So, I mean, you could almost break this into C1. The first sentence of the original statute is, what is the duration of the appointment? The duration of the appointment starts at initial appearance and ends at appeal. That's how this was read in during the First Circuit case, which is really the only pre-1970 case that interprets this. So I would read that sentence as one, and then two, substitution of appointments. You can substitute at any time. B talks about appointment. So the appointment decision is supposed to be made at the initial appearance, right? That's when the defendant comes in and we find out whether they're financially able or not. And I think actually when you read this statute together, I can't say it makes perfect sense, but I 100% disagree with Mr. Patton that it makes no sense. I think it mostly makes good sense. In all of these kinds of instances, there's going to be some kind of initial appearance, right? Even in the context that he's talking about that says all these problems are created, like the Miranda context or the lineup context. Okay, if we want to interrogate a defendant that we've arrested and he invokes his right to counsel, first of all, we're probably not going to continue to interrogate him. But under Miranda, if we want to, he has to have a lawyer. Okay, well, that's fine. He only gets a lawyer if he's financially able, and B says to make that determination, you have to go to court. So somehow there would have to be some sort of initial court presentation where we would come in and where we would then say, hey, this guy is financially available, right? We're not interviewing Elon Musk and he's not asking for a lawyer. This is the normal run-of-the-mill case and he wants a lawyer. Great. Okay, we've had the initial appearance, he gets the lawyer. So I don't think there's any problem on the front end. And on the back end, it runs through appeal. And that's how you make sense of the rest of, now I'm switching back to modern 3006A, but normally it ends at appeal. But if you have a probation violation, this is all going to start over again. He's going to have an initial appearance on his probation violation, and if the violation is found and he's revoked, that's going to continue on through to appeal. The same with E, supervised release violations. The same with F, findings of mental incompetency, including if he's found not guilty and we want to keep things going. It's going to start all over again.
Mr. Holler, can I just pause you? Your position's clear. You and Mr. Patton are as articulate as you can be on this. I got a question about this. For a long time, just you may say I really can't say much, but for a long time, you almost seemed to be the United States almost seem to be of the view that Mr. Patton is articulating. It's, you know, it's not the best written thing. It's ambiguous in some places, but we've kind of worked it out. And these appointments have been happening a long time. You see it in standing orders. And so these are my words, not his. He's saying there's really nothing broken. And therefore, what is there to fix? Because you can make sense of this as a historical matter. But yet here, the United States is before us now taking a position, you know, I mean, yes, to be sure, in response to a briefing order, but taking a position that the statute doesn't authorize it. Can we trust, and I assume we can, this is the position of the Department of Justice?
Yes.
Okay. Can you say anything about, view that as a change, or has that always been the position? And you may not be able to answer that.
As a general matter, the United States, look, this is a question about Article 1 giving funding to Article 3. It's also a question about right to counsel and defender services. Defender services is also located in Article 3. And as a general matter, Article 2 has stayed out of that. So when do we weigh in? We have never weighed in on this. We are not changing our position, okay? We have never weighed in on this before, on this question of whether the Criminal Justice Act authorizes payment of counsel for 3582 proceedings. We were asked to weigh in on that in 2019. That issue was vetted, and the position of the Department of Justice was stated in our brief in Hardin. That case then went away. We were asked to brief the issue again today. The issue has been reviewed again. This is the position of the Department of Justice. I want to make one more comment, and I guess this is just in response to Mr. Patton's repeating that for 60 years we've done it this way, for 60 years we've done it this way. Look, we have done it this way for a long time, and I am not going to disagree with that in any respect, but we have not done it this way for 60 years, okay? When Deering is saying you cannot pay counsel to work on this thing like a new trial motion, all you can do is appoint counsel in the manner of discretion, the court is not saying, and you can pay them. The court is saying what it has always said. Judges have always been able to call the local bar and say, please, will somebody pro bono come and do this case? This court does this in the civil context. The district courts do this in civil context. I am not saying, the Department of Justice is no way saying that that is the perfect or even necessarily a good system. But it is the system that existed in this country, in the federal system, essentially from the 1790s until the early 1960s. And when Deering, and when I think when most of these other 1960s, 1970s cases are saying, hey, can't do it under the Criminal Justice Act, can appoint in discretion, they're not saying, and we can pay you. The idea of discretionary appointments really comes in 1970 when 3006A, at the time G, what is now 3006AA2 comes in, right? So you can see that in the 1971 version. This is on page 10 of the appendix, where discretionary appointments is specifically included. And it talks about revocation of parole, custody as a material witness, certain things that are now mandatory that at the time were viewed as discretionary, 2241, 2254, 2255. So only at that point are certain discretionary appointments paid for, which is still there. It's still there in AA2. It just doesn't include 3582. Okay? And I'm not suggesting by any means that paying counsel or having federal defenders in these cases isn't a great idea and one that Congress shouldn't adopt. I'm just saying it's not in the statute. And it may not have been thought about in 1984. My general sense is prior to 2007, there were very few of these 3582 proceedings. When you look at Tidwell, for example, that's one of the few times that a statute was made retroactive beforehand. For the most part, I think these were just granted or denied out of course. And the fact that there may have been a one-off in Rockford and a few other places where these occurred and nobody really paid attention to it, you know, I don't know. And then suddenly this gets rolled out in 2007 and everybody's like, hey, this would be a great idea if the public defenders are involved, and nobody goes and looks at the statute, I think. But I just think that's where we are.
Mr. Holler, can I ask you about how we should approach this problem on the merits? You know, we're not trying to interpret here a criminal prohibition or a private right of action under civil law. We're talking about appropriations. that involves, on the at least on the occasions I've had a chance to participate or observe that closely, that involves pretty close communication between Congress and its committees and their staffs and the recipients of those appropriations. What significance do you think we can or should give to the budget requests and the information indicating to Congress, we, through the judiciary and in its budget as it applies to the federal defender's offices, have this need and we are intending to spend the money you appropriate to us for this purpose, and Congress doesn't say no?
So I guess my answer to that question would be, look, I think that if the court views this statute as ambiguous and locates a place in the text that supports its position, I think that it's fine to consider that. I think the problem here is we believe that the text is clear. And if the text is clear, the mere fact that people have acquiesced or that these things have gone on, then I don't think the court can consider it. It isn't like the judiciary has been submitting a line item budget for federal defender services for 3582 actions,
right,
and then there's been discussion in committee. So, I mean, it's not that. It's not like, oh, yeah, well, of course. I mean, so that's, I guess, what I would say on that. I see I'm almost out of time. I can talk a little bit about Mr. Patton's point about the Oaks report if the court wants me to.
Can I ask you a question? Well, if you want to make a point on that, we're not going to be stingy with the time here. I got a question for you on scope.
Sure.
Does the government's position, it seems, even though this case is a C2 case, your position applies across 3582C in its entirety. So it hits C1 too, right?
Yes.
Okay. Any other provisions of law where you have post-appeal, I'm just trying to brainstorm. What's the ramifications of the government's position beyond 3582C, if any?
I don't think that there are extensive ramifications. I think that there are probably occasional miscellaneous types of pro se motions that get filed by defendants. The way this court...
Or other types of appointments. I mean, I want to get Mr. Patton's view on this, too. Other kinds of appointments.
I'm not aware of any other kinds of routine appointments that have been being made that would be deemed problematic by this. Most appointments that are being made post-appeal are going to fall into the buckets that are set forth specifically in A1A, including those that are essentially, or A1, excuse me, including those that are going to be constitutionally required, or their...
Definitely habeas, 2241, 2255.
Well, those are all discretionary, right? I mean, yeah,
right,
but 22, well, 20,
I'm just trying to think of the universe of statutes that could be in play. That's all I'm trying to do.
I think so. I mean, I think that most, anything that's sort of seeking an attack on your, I guess the way the court has traditionally, go ahead.
Can I throw something out as a possibility? At least I've seen a few appeals where people are trying to go in long after a direct appeal and deal with disputes about restitution and forfeitures and kind of the implementation of those, which can get pretty messy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be a possibility, I suppose. I mean, I would suggest, Judge Hamilton, I've seen those as well. Most of the people who are involved in fighting about those kinds of assets have assets and are not indigent. But to the extent that they're in the borderline category, it could affect some of those as well. Again, those are small, very relatively infrequent cases. Mm-hmm. I absolutely think those could easily be dealt with through pro bono types of appointments without appointment of paid counsel. Now, I agree that's going to be a much more difficult issue here. The only other point I guess I did want to make is, to the extent that my opponent wants to read the Oaks report to say there was a problem and Congress fixed it, I don't think that's right.
Say that again.
I don't think that the Oaks report sort of fixed this problem by putting in this little $100 new $250 new trial language. If you go to page 26 of the report, there's a paragraph that says, we have this problem about post-trial motions. We think that there's a Deering causes this problem. And then the end of that paragraph says, if Deering is correct, then the act should be amended so that it makes no distinction between motions before and motions after appeal. Okay, that's what it says. And then there's no change. There's no change that says we should, right, there's no change to C about before and after appeal. Then the next paragraph says, by the way, let's set Deering aside. There's this other administrative problem that we have. The administrative problem we have is sometimes the voucher gets closed, bam, mm-hmm. right? And now we want to pay people for stuff, including maybe like this Deering type stuff, right? And in that instance, what we need to do is we need to create a separate thing that says for those motions, you get paid another $100. And Congress did do that. They upped it to 250 and they put in that paragraph's language. So that deals with the administrative issue. And as we've noted in our brief, there's the Kitchen case. There are motions that can occur after the district court civil case is closed out that arise while a case is on appeal or for various other reasons within the time frame. So I realize that's a very narrow bucket of cases, but I would also say $100 or $250 is a very small amount of money, even in 1964. So I don't know that they were suggesting by that that this was that somehow that meant we were opening everything up to the long term. I also would say the Oaks report in general is, if you look even the page before, page 25, what Professor Oaks seems to be trying to do is to interpret the act to extend coverages to situations in to which the right to counsel extends. That's what they're trying to do. And you know, if we time travel back to the mid-1960s, the Supreme Court is drastically expanding the right to counsel, right? Gideon comes down and Miranda comes down and United States versus Wade comes down and this case that they cite that I've never even heard of before about application of probation revocations comes down. But this is the high watermark, right? So it seems to me Professor Oaks is saying, I want to get ahead of the game. I want to try to like see where the court's going to go and how much it's going to expand. Maybe we want to sort of throw a few more things in. And as it turns out, 1967 was kind of the high watermark. I mean, Congress or the Supreme Court hasn't really extended the right to counsel much beyond where it was then. So, and certainly the right to counsel is not extended to 3582 proceedings. So there's no requirement that of that there. And I just don't think that we can read into the Oaks report some finding either that Congress intended that or Congress amended the statute or Congress didn't amend the statute because Deering was wrong, et cetera. In our view, the court therefore should, to the extent that our opponents were only provisionally appointed, the court should reconsider and deny Mr. Bonds' motion for appointment of counsel and should, I'm happy to talk about the merits, but should affirm the Judge Lichty's order denying his reduction.
Okay. Mr. Holler, thank you very much. We really appreciate it. Mr. Patton, we'll give you 5 minutes.
Your Honor, it's a bit hard for me to swallow that the Department of Justice hasn't weighed in on this before. The Oaks report was commissioned by the Department of Justice and the Judicial Conference. All right? And the Oaks report specifically rejected the reading of subsection C that Mr. Holler is asking you to accept. Specifically rejected it. And the Oaks report is crystal clear that the motions that were contemplated being covered by this statutory maximum of $250, they name them. You can read them in the Rule 33 new trial motions that could be filed up to 2 years after the case is done if it's based on new evidence. Rule 35 motions, which at the time could be filed for up to 6 months after direct appeal. Those were the two identified post-trial, post-judgment motions the new statutory maximum was designed to allow to get paid. So you cannot read C the way they want you to. And so my point is, if the Department of Justice thought that was wrong, right, that was wrong, surely the government would be able to point to something in the history then of the statutory process and the amendment process where the Department of Justice said to Congress, oh, well, wait a minute, that reading of C is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Today you don't seem, don't let me put words in your mouth, but you don't seem to be reading C as a source of the authority authorizing the appointment.
We say it's A1, but although I agree, the last sentence of C that Judge Hamilton highlighted speaks in really expansive terms. But C, I mean, the Oaks report specifically says C should be read not as a limitation, but just as to ensure that the coverage lasts through the period of time when it's constitutionally required.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think C is a duration provision. Yeah.
And it doesn't, so the authorization comes from coverage in the federal case, the felony case.
Yeah, it's got to come from right. Something and in just, A.
Yes, and it also just seems odd to me that this is the official position of the Department of Justice, I guess supposedly since 2013 when Foster got decided. But there's been five 3582C cases in the Supreme Court since then where there's appointment of counsel, one of which the Supreme Court itself appoints counsel under the CJA Act, and the Department of Justice doesn't say anything. So it's a little bit hard to square that this is their official position. They haven't been going to other circuits asking other circuits to address this, thank God. But so there seems to be some inconsistency there. And you know, the outlier in all of this is Foster. Foster is the outlier. And Foster didn't even acknowledge this court's prior published opinions interpreting the statute to allow the appointment. And in During said appointment of counsel is not mandatory, but it is left to the discretion of the district court. And let's be clear, when you get appointed under the CJA Act, you get paid. That was the whole point of the CJA. I mean, people were getting appointed before and not getting paid, but the problem was that system stunk and poor people weren't getting the representation that they deserved. And so the whole point of the CJA Act was to say, yes, when you appoint a lawyer in a criminal case, they get paid. That's how you get quality appointment. The idea you're going to recruit counsel to do 50,000 drugs minus two cases is ridiculous. That you're going to recruit counsel to do the First Step Act 404B motions, which are covered under 3582C. You think a pro se defendant's going to be able to do the complex litigation we did over coverage of 404? Under the government's reading, Rule 35B motions, gone. 2 weeks ago, I had two Rule 35B hearings in front of Judge Mim. Both of them, I was able to convince Judge Mim to reduce the sentence for the defendant more than what the government was asking for. If that poor defendant didn't get a lawyer, they would be sitting in prison for longer than they should have. All right. The government's reading results in a massive explosion in the provision of counsel for poor people in this country. Don't make any mistake about it. This just doesn't apply to retroactive guidelines. It's retroactive guidelines. It's reduction in sentences, sometimes called compassionate release. How is somebody who's terminally ill, sitting in a prison, supposed to get their medical records together to present to a judge, get a release plan put together for a judge as to where am I going to stay? How am I going to get health care? We've had multiple people, one in particular in the Central District, where everybody agreed, dying, right? He got recruited counsel. But Judge Mims, like, recruited counsel's in Maryland. Judge Mims, like, all right, he's dying. I'll let him out. But you guys have to give me a detailed release plan of how in Champaign, Illinois, this is going to work. Guess who did the work putting together the release plan? In going out and saying, this is the doctor he'll get. This is how he'll get state paid insurance. It was our office, because recruited counsel picked up the phone and said, how do I do this? And we're like, look, we'll do it. And we did it. And that's a guy I represented in 1997 who got life on bank robbery. And he was able to at least get out and have some dignity as he was dying from cancer. Would not happen without letting poor people not just get appointed lawyers that get paid.
Okay. Very well. Mr. Patton, many thanks to you. Mr. Holler, many thanks to you and the government. We really appreciate this. This is extraordinarily high quality advocacy. We appreciate it very much. We will take the appeal under advisement. We're going to stand in recess.